Welcome to Voices. This is Alan Wilcox, Editor-in-Chief of Epidemiology. In 2002, the journal began a project to interview our field's most senior and accomplished practitioners. In these interviews, scientists reflect on their careers, their professional influences, and on the future of epidemiology. The interview you're about to hear is with Margaret Becklake. Dr. Becklake trained in medicine in South Africa and the UK, where she specialized in pulmonary physiology. She began her work in epidemiology in the 1950s as the physiologist for South Africa's Miners Medical Bureau, studying lung function in gold miners. Since joining McGill's Epidemiology and Health Department in 1967, Dr. Becklake has devoted her career to studying environmental and occupational determinants of childhood and adult airway disease, in particular the lung health of asbestos miners and millers. This interview was conducted by Pierre Ernst in 2003.
This is an interview being held March 25th, 2003. For the feature Voices, a feature of the journal Epidemiology. My name is Pierre Ernst, and it's a pleasure today and an honor to be able to interview Professor Margaret Becklake, Professor of Epidemiology at McGill University. Good morning, Professor Becklake.
Good morning, Pierre.
I'll start with the questions as they've been given to us. And the first one, few people start with the intent of becoming an epidemiologist. Can you describe how your own path brought you to epidemiology?
I came to epidemiology from a need for the information I hoped it was going to supply. I'd been trained in respiratory physiology, which addressed issues of mechanism in lung disease, and realized that causes, background, were not going to be learned from the study of cases. And so it was a need.
Can you describe your own path that brought you to epidemiology? Because you say it was from, so it's from a clinical perspective. You started off with the cases and you wanted to be able to deduce something for what you were seeing in the cases?
I studied medicine in Johannesburg during World War I, and the word epidemiology was not in
not
the curriculum.
Not during World War I, Dr. Beck.
A mistake.
I'm sure it was II. World War II.
It was different to World War II. Epidemiology was not in the curriculum. Okay. In my postgraduate training, which was in London after the war, was extremely interesting, and it focused on respiratory epidemiology. At the time, London was filled with ex-servicemen from World War II, anxious to catch up on their own training and, in a sense, to reshape the world for their children. They were an extremely interesting group to be a part of. And
you said the focus was on respiratory epidemiology or respiratory
physiology?
Physiology.
Yes. And I studied at the postgraduate medical school. And the answers in those days came from pathology. Clinical path rounds, which were held every day at lunchtime, involved all specialists from all fields, and their fighting or commentary was merciless.
Yes.
But it was a model of interdisciplinary activity which my husband and I were both fascinated by and hoped to take back to South Africa when we returned.
But so you went back to South Africa as a respiratory physician, trained in respiratory physiology. Where now, I guess, in the late 40s, maybe early 50s by now.
Yes.
I think there were a few children involved, if I remember correctly. But at some point, you came to epidemiology. I don't think we've gotten there yet.
My contact with epidemiology really resulted from a chance conversation with Dr. John Gilson, who was head of the MRC pneumoconiosis research unit in South Wales, mm-hmm. focus on coal miners' disease.
And this was still when you were in South Africa then?
It was actually on occasion a visit to England. Visit. Mm-hmm. And when I told him that the Miners' Bureau, to which I'd been appointed as physiologist, was responsible for the compulsory pre-employment and annual medical mm-hmm. examinations of every active miner, he said what a remarkable opportunity it was to sample from their number and address epidemiological questions. Mm-hmm. It was a luxury, if you like, which his unit had never enjoyed. If he wished to do the same thing, he would have to mount a field survey mm-hmm. and go around to all the different pits, coal pits, in all of England mm-hmm. to get the same sort of information that I had the opportunity to tap into.
Because it was centralized.
Uh-huh. Because in order to mine, you had to have an active mining ticket, which meant that you had to have passed this annual medical examination. Okay. And the material that was recorded, which included an X-ray, was housed in that one location.
So you had the first cohort, a longitudinal cohort of coal miners.
Yeah. Miners. In fact, ours were hard rock miners, mm-hmm. gold miners, on which, of course, the economy of the country mm-hmm. largely depended then.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I think I'd like to come back at some point how you got into the epidemiology of asbestos. Do you want to address that now, or do you want to address that at a later question? Because obviously that was epidemiology too. I guess it sounds possibly a logical course from the epidemiology of the respiratory disease in gold miners to the epidemiology of respiratory disease in asbestos workers.
Well, our family moved to Quebec in 1967. Mm-hmm. And early in the 1970s, I was invited by Dr. Corbett MacDonald to join the Department of Epidemiology and set up a lung function laboratory in support of his research into the ill health effects of exposure of crocodile miners and millers in Quebec. He had this project had been undertaken on the impetus, really, of the International Commission on Occupational Health, which had identified several important questions that should be addressed, one of which was to determine whether there were gradients in the health effects of the different asbestos fibers. Mm-hmm. In Quebec, there was a group of miners and millers exposed very largely, almost primarily, to crocodile with perhaps some premolite contamination. Mm-hmm. And the opportunity of gathering this data was judged to be important in the contributing to the international mm-hmm. knowledge at the time.
And you had the experience, I guess, with the exams in the gold miners.
Yes.
Did you use lung function in the exams of gold miners also?
Absolutely. We used resting and exercise lung function uh-huh. in very much the same way as we did in Quebec. Mm-hmm. The technology, of course, was different in mm-hmm. Johannesburg. In Johannesburg, for instance, it's situated at 6,000 feet above sea mm-hmm. level, where the air is thin. And this, what is expected, what is, quotes, normal at mm-hmm. that altitude, affects both the oxygen tension in the blood and mm-hmm. it affects the flow rates because you're breathing thin air. Mm-hmm. So what was normal at that altitude had to be established. Mm-hmm. It's interesting that at that time, miners who lived almost a mile above sea level would, and those involved in the deepest mining, would go down to a mile below sea level mm-hmm. in the course of a day.
So this is, now I understand where your interest in predicted values and normal lung function mm. comes from. I mean, you were faced with this problem based on altitude in South yeah. Africa and the differences when you came here. What is the biggest difference between epidemiology that was practiced when you started your career and epidemiology today?
I think the biggest difference is undoubtedly the technology which allows one's statistical consultants to handle material.
Mm-hmm.
I'd like to quote an example. One of our first studies was a comparison of gold miners with and without silicosis.
Mm-hmm.
We did a number of lung function tests, and we had to consolidate them into a single index of performance.
Mm-hmm.
Based on one, what tests measured different types of lung function based on biology, and secondly, whether there was any interrelationship between the two of them.
Mm-hmm.
And to do this, the statistical consultant, Professor Lutz from the mathematical department of the university, not a biostatistician, used a discriminant analysis for which it was necessary to invert a matrix.
Uh-huh.
So we had something like 240 data points.
Mm-hmm.
In a recent study that I did in Quebec in collaboration with six other centers across Canada in adult asthma, we were dealing with 16,000 mm-hmm. subjects in which we had, I think, 8 symptoms and so many risk factors.
Mm-hmm.
And the first analysis could not be carried out by Professor Lutz. He hadn't access to any computer that had the memory and the time to do this
this computation.
Yes, this computation.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
So the data was sent to England by airmail, which took 3 days, and the computer that was used was the computer of a restaurant chain, which was Lance Corner Houses. And this came back some weeks later.
Mm-hmm.
Nowadays, the study that was handled, the cross-Canada study of asthma in 6 cities, was done on a desktop computer
And that's right, and the results were sent to everybody by
1.7
email.
Million points of information dealt with on a desktop, probably in a single afternoon.
So you really feel the biggest difference is this really computational technology that allows us much more complicated analysis and obviously much more rapid analysis.
Yes.
Very interesting. Who would you single out as having most strongly influenced your career? I suspect there are a few.
I think there are a few, but I think I would single out Professor Crabe,
mm-hmm.
who was professor of medicine when I was a student in Johannesburg. He was an interesting individual. He'd grown up on a farm in the Eastern Cape. He had served in the South African forces in France in World War I, had mm-hmm. earned 2 military crosses. He'd then trained in medicine in London. There were no medical schools in South Africa mm-hmm. before 1922, and in the course of his training, he had become interested in how the heart muscle generated the electricity that resulted in the electrocardiogram.
Mm-hmm.
And he had, in fact, challenged his superior, Dr. Sir Thomas Lewis, to, in his concepts and in conceived experiments, which he used to demonstrate his point.
So this was the 1920s, and he was challenging the professor.
Absolutely.
Yes.
So that he taught us in much the same way. Mm-hmm. He expected us to challenge everything that did not fit our mm-hmm. clinical concept, our clinical observations, whether or not it fitted current dogma.
Mm-hmm.
He said that if he or anybody else taught anything that didn't fit, we should go to the library and inform ourselves of the most up-to-date views.
Mm-hmm.
And this is probably something that I've tried to follow mm-hmm. all my life. It's embedded in my thinking.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I've known this well. that you certainly do not always follow current dogma, but anyway, because it led to some very interesting findings. Collaboration is essential to successful epidemiological studies. What have you found to be the most important ingredients of a good collaboration?
Collaborators who share the same passion for the question asked. I've had collaborations with colleagues inside and outside of Quebec, collaborations with colleagues in Kenya, collaborations in South Africa. Each of them has been rewarding, and I wouldn't care to rate any one of them as more useful or more rewarding than another. They've all worked well.
So I won't ask you who your best collaborations are. Okay. Whom would you regard as the two or three most important epidemiologists during your lifetime, and on what basis?
I think I would list them as follows: Professor Dahl, Archie Cochrane, Corbett MacDonald, and Rothman. I have met the first three of them, and Rothman only through reading his book. What were the features? For Dahl, I think his studies, first of all as an assistant to Bradford Hill and then as a collaborator in examining the links between cancer and cigarette smoking, were a model for chronic disease epidemiology, which was the preoccupation of epidemiologists in the last half of the last century. Cochrane was head of the Medical Research Council in, of the Medical Research Unit in Cardiff, Wales, close to where Dr. Gilson functioned. And the close collaboration between the two of them I always found interesting. MacDonald, I think, is a very, I guess I learned most epidemiology from working with Corbett MacDonald. He's an interesting, original individual. You would take a project to him or a protocol, he would criticize it from many aspects. And when you thought you'd really have to abandon the project, he'd turn it around into a simple, come to closure with a rather simple design. I think he always taught us that le meilleur, c'est l'ennemi du bien, attributed to Voltaire, and that we should be practical in our planning, and he definitely was.
And then Dr. Rothman.
Dr. Rothman, learned through reading his book, and I find his description of what I think is a very important tenet in epidemiology, that an epidemiological study should be regarded as an exercise in measurement with accuracy as its goal. It's a very important reminder, and one to which I
I've dedicated a lot of research to, I think, in the lung function field.
Exactly, and measurement is extremely important, and I think it's, I find myself very much in sympathy with that
view.
That statement, yes.
Okay. Which do you think has been your most influential paper?
I think my most influential paper has been a paper called Asbestos-Related Diseases of the Lungs and Other Organs. Their implications for clinical practice.
Is this the review paper in the old blue journal then?
Yes, in the American Review of Tuberculosis and Lung Disease in 1976.
I think it was already the American Review of Respiratory Diseases
It could be. What I think that was important, and it came about like this: when Corbett MacDonald was completing his studies in asbestos miners, they were being reported in epidemiology or public health journals, and I thought they were extremely important to the practice of medicine mm-hmm. and to clinicians who didn't read those journals, or even if they did read those journals, didn't necessarily see the clinical implications. Mm-hmm. And I said this to him, and he said, well, write a review. Uh-huh. It happened to coincide with an invitation from the then editor, mm-hmm. John Murray, to write a piece on asbestos. So the mm-hmm. two things coincided, and I wrote yeah. that paper on that.
That was a very influential paper, and actually that whole series was a very influential review. Those reviews in general, they were actually published separately for a while.
That's right, they were published separately, and I think they were mm-hmm. very useful, mm-hmm. And a challenge to write, and mm-hmm. very useful to the clinical mm-hmm. reader.
So then we have to go to the next question, which is, which has been your most underappreciated paper?
That was a paper by myself and Umesh Lalu entitled, where's the title of that paper?
This is on the healthy smoker effect.
Oh, the healthy smoker effect, mm-hmm. a phenomenon of health selection. Mm-hmm. We had reviewed the data and were struck by the fact that the phenomenon of healthy smoker occurred in the same populations as the phenomenon of the healthy mm-hmm. worker.
This was a review paper, really.
It was a review paper.
Actually, today it would have been done as a meta-analysis, probably.
Oh, undoubtedly, yes, undoubtedly. And the interest there is that the healthy worker effect had been described in relation to mortality, mm-hmm. but not in relation to morbidity, mm-hmm. which was clearly it was clearly related to morbidity mm-hmm. based on our own studies. Mm-hmm. And the fact that the two phenomena, the healthy worker and the healthy smoker effect, occurred in the same populations struck us as interesting, because they implied that a combination of what you breathed in was important. Mm-hmm. And this really, nobody took any notice of that paper.
I'm not sure I would agree with that, but it was certainly not as well appreciated as the asbestos
no.
paper.
Mm.
How have you chosen the research questions that you want to address?
As Professor Crabb taught us, addressing questions that patients mm-hmm. and individuals bring to you based on your own experience or other people's experience, where observation, what you observe, does not fit clinical dogma. Mm-hmm.
So you feel that it's they really come from clinical questions.
Yes.
Okay. Which of your contributions to the field would you most like to be remembered for?
For any contribution I made to the evidence that work-related exposures may cause COPD. Mm-hmm. In other words, COPD is not exclusively a cigarette-related mm-hmm. disease. The information has been relatively slow to gather. Mm-hmm. It started out with the very first studies we did in South African mm-hmm. gold miners, which showed that the lung function abnormality was not related to the presence or absence of silicosis mm-hmm. in that study. The germ of the idea was there. It's interesting. It seemed to take on because the influential American Conference of Government and Industrial Hygienists, who set or propose threshold limit values for mm-hmm. exposure, in a sense recognized it, because they made the point that something that they used to call nuisance dust mm-hmm. should now be called particles not otherwise classified. Mm-hmm. Because the term nuisance dust, as they point out, implies that even whatever the concentration, mm-hmm. this does not have mm-hmm. harmful effects. So that was an important step. This happened during about the mid-1990s. Mm-hmm. And I think that was an important step. And most recently, in the March issue of the American Review
now the American
Journal
of
Respiratory and Critical Care Medicine, has published a workshop mm-hmm. on the burden of occupational contribution mm-hmm. to the burden of airway disease, and estimates that it's of the order of 15% mm-hmm. in many studies. So I think those two points
I think
information.
It's accepted now, but I remember yes. training with you at a time where I thought the only two people in the world that actually were convinced were you and me. And so I'm actually yes. very happy to see yes. that other people seem convinced, yes. but it only took 20 years.
Only 20 years.
What have been your major interests outside your epidemiological activities?
As a family, and possibly because my husband grew up on a farm in South Africa, mm-hmm. we've always been interested in the country around us, mm-hmm. particularly its evolution through the seasons. Mm-hmm. And we've been able to observe this through owning a log cabin mm-hmm. in a farm in the Eastern Township.
Yeah.
Yes, in a lovely part mm-hmm. of Quebec. The other interest of the family, possibly because we've lived in three continents and have friends there, has been in the economic, social, political mm-hmm. events of the world. They've always been a subject of our dinner table mm-hmm. conversation, and followed now, in a sense, through the contacts and friends that we have mm-hmm. in these parts of the world.
Yes, you've... We won't get into politics. I think mm-hmm. I was going to make a comment, but I probably don't want to publish that. So, in your opinion, what has been epidemiology's most important contribution to society?
Hmm. I think the transfer of the concept of measurement error into the public domain. Mm-hmm. We read public opinion polls used for all sorts of reasons. Mostly they say X percentage mm-hmm. of subjects questioned answered yes to the following question. Mm-hmm. And then they say that this figure is a 5% error of estimate. Mm-hmm. Now, I think the public needs protection against the false advertising claims mm-hmm. of whatever, mm-hmm. whether it's drugs, drink, or food. mm-hmm. They also need protection against the rather flamboyant claims of new diseases that are threatening them or new mm-hmm. treatments that mm-hmm. are going to cure their ills. Mm-hmm. And I think most of the public has had the experience of the predictions falling in that 5% unpredicted, mm-hmm. unexpected. Mm-hmm. So I think that's an important component. I think that's an important contribution mm-hmm. of epidemiology to everyday life.
What is your assessment of the current state of the health of epidemiology?
Well, I think the current state is good. Mm-hmm. The health of epidemiology is good.
We seem to be doing quite well. Yeah.
Yes.
Do you see risks that our profession faces?
I think the biggest risk is maintaining the balance between the effort that we put in, and effort by that I mean time,
resources.
Energy, money, mm-hmm. resources, mm-hmm. Between more or less important issues, mm-hmm. that a lot of energy seems to go into a lot of relatively unimportant issues. Mm-hmm. One of the things that concerns me as someone who grew up in Africa is the, I guess, lack of involvement of the richer parts of the world not affected by the AIDS mm-hmm. TB epidemic in the issues of great concern there. Mm-hmm. I was extremely, in a sense, touched at a course that we were running in Durban in collaboration with Professor Lelou mm-hmm. on protocol development. And all the participants from South Africa and neighboring countries said, every one of our protocols has to deal something with TB and AIDS. That mm-hmm. is the issue. Mm-hmm. All of us must contribute in whatever way we can. Mm-hmm. And it was quite touching.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Do you want to mention what you think the opportunity? So actually, if I interpret you correctly, I think there's maybe an opportunity for Western epidemiologists to do something about HIV and TB in the third world?
Yes. I suppose particularly in directing funds, mm-hmm. particularly in encouraging, mm-hmm. I think it's most important that they do their own research. Mm-hmm. It's most important that they own their own research and generate their own mm-hmm. questions. I subscribe to the view expressed by John Evans in something describing something called essential national health research, mm-hmm. saying that the beginning of taking responsibility for what goes on in your country is developing the resources and personnel mm-hmm. who will do the mm-hmm. fact-finding gathering. This is usually descriptive epidemiology. Mm-hmm. This is regarded a little bit with disdain mm-hmm. in the way we teach epidemiology. But it's extremely important, and there are people who need to know, governments, mm-hmm. municipalities, regions, mm-hmm. for distribution of resources. And I think we should encourage respect for descriptive epidemiology. Okay. Mm.
Do you have any predictions about what the future might hold for our field?
I think that every useful discipline, and epidemiology is definitely useful, mm-hmm. A useful discipline dealing with observations in living creatures, and mm-hmm. we deal with humans, but of course it deals with a whole lot of others, it can mm-hmm. do, is increasingly used in other areas. Mm-hmm. It will be used, evidence-based medicine, climate change, mm-hmm. intention to vote, mm-hmm. political pollsters use it, and I think that's probably where it will develop.
So really as a tool
as
to
a
be
tool.
Used in all sorts of other fields.
Exactly. Okay. In fact, that corresponds very closely to Dr. Miettinen's description of epidemiology as a tool, or he calls it a discipline, mm-hmm. not a science, because mm-hmm. he describes a science as an organized body of knowledge, theoretical knowledge, mm-hmm. about a particular topic. Mm-hmm. Epidemiology is a tool, mm-hmm. and in a sense we learn it in application.
Mm-hmm. I'm going to switch the order of questions a little bit. I'm going to finish with the last one, but I'd like to go to the question that I've added, which is to explain why students have always been such a priority for you.
Well, students are our investment in the future. Mm-hmm. Students, like one's children, ask questions when they want to know the answers. You shouldn't put them off. You should try and answer when the question's asked, because that's mm-hmm. when the curiosity is there and the answer will be listened to. Mm-hmm. And the second reason is something that I think we learned from Professor Crabbe, that students come to a set of facts or observations with a fresh point mm-hmm. of view. They have no baggage.
Mm-hmm. No dogma.
No dogma behind mm-hmm. them. And if you listen, it's extremely refreshing at mm-hmm. times. And I think it's a voice that we should not cut off. Mm-hmm. We should always be aware of it.
Okay. And the last question is, what would be the single most important piece of advice you could give a new epidemiologist starting their career?
I'd like to quote a graffiti that I read in a London underground. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. It said, God is the answer. Mm-hmm. And underneath it was somebody written, and we presume it's an epidemiology student, but what is the question? Mm-hmm. I think as a student, I would urge you to become involved in what you think are important questions, mm-hmm. in the why of what you're studying, not so much in the how. Mm-hmm. The methods can nearly always be worked out, but concentrate on the why mm-hmm. and the importance of the research question.
Dr. Becklake, any last word that you would like to add?
Thank you for being a delightful interviewer.
Well, thank you very much. And I think that's it.
Thanks for listening to Voices, a project of the journal Epidemiology. We hope you enjoyed it. You may also be interested in a short video clip of this interview, which you can access through the journal's website. An edited version of this interview was published in the March 2004 issue of the journal.